Blog Talk Radio.
Tonight we will go back in time to seasons past, when 22 men graced the rugged fields of yesterday, fighting for one more first down, one more yard gain, one final score which would bring victory after 60 minutes of battle on the gridiron. Tonight we'll explore the world of gridiron greats. Welcome to Gridiron Greats Football History and its Memorabilia on the Gridiron Greats Publishing and Broadcasting Network. In conjunction with Stuck Enterprises, we're live from the Wallingford, Connecticut home of Gridiron Greats Magazine, and I'm Bob Slick, publisher and editor of Gridiron Greats Magazine. I'll be your host for the show. Gridiron Greats Magazine is the only publication in America which focuses upon the history and memorabilia of the North American football game since its inception in 1869. We cover 140-plus years of football history and memorabilia. And you can find us on the web at www.gridirongreatsmagazine.com. We're sponsored in part by MSB Sports Cards. Check out their website at msbsportscards.com. And also by BST Auctions. Check out their website on their upcoming auctions for bstauctions.com. It is at this time I'd like to introduce my co-host, who is a senior contributing writer to Gridiron Greats Magazine, a football memorabilia historian, specializing in pre-World War II items, in particular Red Grains, and also Seattle Seahawk items, in particular Steve Largent. He hails from Portland, Oregon, Mr. Joe Squires. Joe, welcome to the show.
Great to be here, Captain, as always, sir.
And I'd like to express, before we get started, to all our military men and women, veterans past and present, who have served, today is Armed Forces Day. I'd like to wish everyone a very happy and peaceful Armed Forces Day, and thank you and all our veterans and current members of the military who are serving for their service to our country.
Well said, Bob.
You and I talked briefly about some unopened material that has gone to auction. Can you give our audience a little feedback and background on it?
Well, used to be a big unopened guy, but a couple years ago I kind of changed focus on how I collect, just like all of us are privy to do. But Mile High Up and Coming has a large cache of unopened material wax that they found that an article came out about in SED. The showcase of this is the 48 Bowman baseball partial set, partial box. But we're a football podcast, so we glaze over those details and move right on to the football unopened that we found. 61 mm-hmm. Topps football nickel packs, full box. 62 Topps, one of the hardest sets out there, the black bordered beauties partial box, 20 out of 24. 62 Fleer and 61 Fleer football. They don't say what series. Obviously, if this is first series, it'd be kind of a windfall. That's very, very rare.
Mm-hmm.
Second series
mm-hmm.
is pretty common. But a lot of unopened being found out there, and not just football, but baseball. And also in that mix was a 61 Fleer basketball. I mean, you know, like I said, we're football, but, you know, you can't be a collector and not have paid attention to 61 Fleer basketball set at some point. And, you know, it's just amazing. We've talked about it before,
gotcha.
Just how much unopened is out there, how much more is to be found, how much is stuffed in a closet somewhere. It's amazing. These things amaze me.
One thing that, Joe, I want you to tell our audience, and you have a lot of experience in unopened material, how or what kind of, not so much collation, do you imagine that can come out of these types of wax boxes and wax packs, But how many cards are permanently damaged from the wax pack, meaning that the glue might, from the wrapper, might, I don't know, for lack of a better term, melt into the last or the first card, or the gum might disintegrate into the card? What's your background on that as far as what's happened to you when you've opened an open material like that?
Great question. The oldest unopened I've ever opened, I think, is 78. Well, I've had a couple like a 55 Bowman accidentally flop open on me and you see the gum. But that's a very good question. Even as recent, packs like 1984, which is one that, my favorite, the gum almost permanently stains card it's up against. And they usually have the seal, up against the gum. So you get into something like, I've had 61 Fleer football packs before, but I've never opened one, interestingly enough. I just thought of that. 62 football, I've never seen a pack. Or I've never owned a pack, excuse me. I've seen them out there. But 61 Topps football I used to have. I don't know where the gum is positioned in accordance with the seal on the back. But as being a young lad who's opened his share of wax packs, the wax seal, used to leave a line where the roller would run down it, and the gum stain. Sometimes you can get that gum stain out. I mean, I've heard people talk about taking a nylon and rubbing it out. You're basically heating the gum up to liquefy it, and then the nylon picks it up. I've seen heard people talk about using a hair dryer. I've heard all kinds of different methods, but yeah, and it's generally just the age of this, the pack, just the edges that get dinged up. But the provenance of these unopened box is that this was a salesman. He was either a salesman or a rep for the company, and he was the person who was out on the road who was supposed to set these up as displays, and he just stuffed them in the closet. And it's just fascinating to think about how many more of these packs, boxes, are stuffed in closets somewhere. And the Holy Grail, we've talked about what our Holy Grail would be in 48 leaf football, 35 chickle. Those would be amazing finds, and you can keep your fingers crossed that somebody's got a grandfather or great-grandfather who worked for Leaf or Chickle who stuffed one of those boxes in their closet, and they'll come to market one of these days and think of the fireworks that go off with just a 48-leaf pack. We've seen wax paper wrappers, but never seen a full leaf football pack. I mean, and that's not so distant history. I mean, what is that, 52? I mean, that's 60, 70 years ago, and not even a visual of what the display looks like is pretty incredible.
Well, I think what will be interesting to me, what's interesting to me is, A, I know there are a lot of investors out there who buy the unopened material and they just sit on it, they get it wrapped, they get it slabbed, yada, 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 and they never open it. But what will be interesting to see is over the next year or so, if any actual real old unopened wax packs actually get open and they get documented, obviously on like a YouTube video or something like that. And as such, we can actually see what happens with the card. It was interesting you brought up the 84 Topps because probably, I would say 5 or 6 months ago, I was at a show and a dealer had some 83 Topps football, and a couple guys bought the remaining packs he had and they ended up breaking them open. And it was interesting to see one card was basically ruined with the wax on it, and the other card basically had the gum literally adhered to the front of the card. So it was basically the gum was on the top card of the pack, so it would be raised up slightly, and then you had the wax seal go into it. Yeah.
Yeah, and the 84 football, the gum was in the middle, so they had eleven cards on one side, 10 on the other, with the play, the scratch off play card in the middle, and then the gum. Yeah. And so you got a lot of bowing. The bottom would bow, as it wrapped around the gum, and that card was ruined. And then the gum faced the play card on the other side, so that was a push.
Right.
Yeah. I've opened the most 84 football. So.
Yeah. It's amazing to see. And I remember 2 or 3 years ago at a national, I opened up a 76 waxback football, figuring I would probably get 3 or 4 paintings out of the pack, but obviously I didn't. And it was interesting to see the gum actually did not adhere to the top card, and it was pretty pretty clean. And I knew it was not a rewrap because it was one of my own packs I bought back in 76. I put them away. And I still have a bunch of packs from the 70s and 80s that I still have. I open them on occasion, one way or the other. But I was fascinated to see what a nasty pack that was, all commons. But there were beautiful commons seeing them come out of the packs because they were basically almost gem mint coming out. And I didn't have any wax seal problems, which I think was the reason being they were stored pretty well over the years, you know, over the past 40 years plus when I bought them in 76. So it's kind of interesting to see that.
And this is tough because unopened wax is very nostalgic to me. I mean, I look at a box. You have a picture on the SCD article of the 62 Topps football. And you think about how hard it is to get good graded 62 Topps. And you just think about all the packs that were opened to get, you know, the population we have now. And it's incredibly nostalgic to look at that. But unless you have provenance, something like this, I mean, you know, resealers and, you know, and fake wax packs. I mean, even, you know, somebody years ago, you know, I discovered there was somebody out there making fake BBCE, you know, shrink wrap and labels.
Yeah.
You know, we've talked about the crooks out there being one step ahead of us. I mean, you know, so I look at packs like this, and it's kind of, I mean, I'm nostalgic on the one hand. This is exciting. This is cool. On the other hand, this is the one break or one find where, you know, you have provenance where you can be like, this is authentic versus, you know, something like this just came to market through an auction.
Right. And it's interesting. I briefly looked at some of my 60 stuff over the past couple of weeks. My sets, and I did look through my 62 set, and man, I got some serious beaters in that set, and I also got some nice cards. And, you know, again, because I wasn't, you know, condition prone when I bought a lot of stuff, whatever I found, I, you know, if it was card number 100 for the set, that's where it went. But the 62, I know the black border, it's almost like the 85 FAPS with the, you know, similar black border. And a similar problem, you know, 20-some-odd years later, printing, that, you know, they couldn't get the black borders consistent one way or the other. So, truly
you,
amazing.
You think about the cards in this 62 set, I mean, you know, it's pretty incredible. There's just, it's one of the more difficult sets out there. I started down that path once and then gave up just because it was, just a PSA 7 or PSA 8 card. Was tough. Mm-hmm. That was back in my PSA days when I was a collector, a set collector.
That's to me a set. To me, it's a shame that they're slab number one, especially the 62s. I think they're more meant to be enjoyed, raw sheets
The years of exposure to you, Bob. I'm starting to drift to be your way, where more and more of my set, my collection is raw or, you know, in plastic top holders where I can pull them out and hold them as, you know, God intended.
I was talking to a longtime collector the other afternoon on the phone, and he was saying, he's kind of like me, but he's a lot older than me. He just said, I just can't get into these graded cards. He's been offered numerous times, you know, people want to grade his stuff, blah, blah, blah. And he says, I just can't do it. He says, maybe when I'm dead and gone, whoever disposes of it, let him grade it. But, you know, not now. Yeah, I can't do that.
Problem is, whenever anybody comes over to his house with his cards, he tells them to get off his damn porch.
Yeah. It is just unbelievable. Well, we talk about unopened material. I distinctly remember 1965 Topps first cards I ever opened as a kid, and I distinctly remember, thinking about it, that there's the magic rub-off emblem in the 65 wax pack, and I mistakenly put a lot of those on notebooks and stuff as I was growing up, and I played with them, but the 65 Topps unopened had the bubblegum on the top card, and the bottom was the magic rub-off. And so when you opened up the pack, you got the rub-off, and then you had to take all your cards out, and then your gum was either sticking to the top of the pack or to the top card. And then I obviously would chew my gum right then and there, have a good wad in my jaw, and then study my cards afterwards. And it was pretty neat to think about, you know, going back to 1965. Again, if we said it once, we said it 100 times, the hobbies evolved. It was never, really wasn't a hobby at one time. Now it's a, you know, multi-million dollar business, yada, yada, yada. But at the same time, you know, for purists like myself, 2016 football season was pretty bittersweet because there was no top space cards available. Everything was Panini, and there are 5,000 different brands or how many ever they had that they printed. And it just didn't feel the same to me, not opening up any Topps football for the year. But I have very, very pleasant memories, to say the least, for the 65 set, opening them up. And the 65 Phillies, which hold a dear spot in my heart, all the Philly sets. I still remember, too, one of the smaller places I used to buy cards, which my mother never liked me going, was an old couple that ran a like a soda and candy shop in Branford, Connecticut. And then you would walk in and automatically you would be deemed that you were stealing from them type of thing, even if you placed your order right in front of them, gave them your change type of thing. Anyways, I remember he had a handful of packs of 64 Philly when I went in there, and he didn't know what they were. He just said they were older cards. So I remember buying two packs at one time of them. Those were my first 64 Phillies. But this was very late in the 65 season. But I still remember seeing him on the display. He had all his candy and all the little wax boxes together and all that. It was pretty interesting.
For our guests, Bob and I had two topics we wanted to discuss today. And Bob perfectly segued over in our second topic. Our first section was the unopened, you know, coming up for sale here pretty quick. And then we wanted to discuss a young mustachioed, you know, Bob Swick as a child, you know, buying 65 tops. We wanted to start taking, you know, sets and discussing them in depth. 65 tops being the captain's, you know, first and favorite set is what we decided to start into. And the captain perfectly segued from wax into 65 wax and talking about that. But I love the memories. You know, you told the story a couple times of just, you know, and I would just imagine a young version of you with a big bushy mustache as a, you know, 9-10 year old child. I always imagine you always have that mustache and just walking in and plunking your nickel down and buying it. But you think about how rare 65 tops is right now. I mean, and you think about the rarity of that, and the captain of our hobby bought 65 tops football wax packs, opened them up, and pulled a Joe Namath at one point out of a wax pack.
Yep.
And there's our history right there.
I still have that Joe Namath in my collection. I won't get rid of it, but that is the card. It's not, and you know, I graded probably VGEX because I did handle it with my greasy hands back then, and I studied it left and right, and I can remember when newspapers actually reported sports the way they did. So many pictures of Namath in the paper, so I would compare those pictures to my card. And sometimes I would say, well, this card doesn't look real. I mean, he doesn't look like he looks like on TV or in the newspapers type of thing. And it's fascinating to think about the time frame of looking at that stuff. You know, it's amazing.
That name is a VG to PSA, but it's a PSA 10 in your heart, Captain. And I think I mentioned I happen to have an uncut sheet, a partial uncut sheet of 65 tops, and I'm looking at it right now. I brought it into the Portland, Oregon sound booth, aka my spare bedroom in my house where I usually do the show. You know, this partial set is five rows and 11 columns. So, I mean, it's obviously half, or the lower half of a sheet. So right there in the middle of the sheet, you know, what would be the middle of the sheet? It's the top row of my partial, is Hollywood Joe Namath's card. And I've It's in horrid shape. I mean, the top's scuffed up. There's a crease down it. But at one point, we've talked about how our collecting habits have changed. And I used to collect wax packs and cellos, but mm-hmm. I became afraid of resealers. And my collecting habits, about 3-4 years ago, really drifted to uncut sheets because you can't fake these. I mean, I'm looking at this mm-hmm. uncut sheet, and I know 100% in my mind this is real. This came off the factory floor. But here's mm-hmm. Joe Namath staring back at me, and I've sat down to try and figure out how these things were collated or what sense they made of, where they placed anybody on the sheet, and it mm-hmm. doesn't make sense. Numerically, they're all over the board. Team-wise, they're all over the board. Conference-wise, they're all over the board. It's just, it's interesting.
I'm wondering, keeping in line with 65 tops, I do have a bunch of duplicates, a lot of them from my childhood. Maybe I should just strictly collect now 65 tops football and just keep putting sets together for my remaining time collecting. And then I'll have 14, 15 sets completed and then flood the market with them.
When you were a kid, did you complete the set? Did you complete the set?
No, I was short probably a good 15 cards that escaped me. And it wasn't until the late 70s I actually found those cards. Because when I started going shows in the mid-70s, late 70s, you know how tough it was trying to find football. And 65 tops were just nowhere to be found. And New Haven Coliseum had a couple bigger shows, and I hit upon a dealer from New York who actually had them, and I bought them for some ridiculous price. I think he charged me 50 cents a card or whatever back then. I finished the set, but I always kept my duplicates. And I picked up duplicates along the way, too.
Do you know the difference in your 65 top set? Do you know the difference in your 65 top set of the cards you pulled as a kid versus the cards you purchased later?
I can tell. I can definitely tell which is which. And I got a good handle on which 15 cards were there. I could probably dig out the notebook I wrote it down in my archives. But great memories. But our guest is here, and I want to move along. Our guest tonight is a commander of the Naval Forces Europe, 6th Fleet diplomat to the Italian Naval Commander of the United States Navy. He is an Ohio State football collector and Ohio State football historian. He's calling in from Rome, Italy. And I'd like to welcome to our show Mr. Dan Elfass. Dan, welcome to the show.
Hey, guys. Thanks. I'm greatly honored, first and foremost. Although I'm not calling from my spare bedroom as others are. That made me chuckle a bit because I can just envision getting you bought too many cards one day and the old lady sends you and says you're not sleeping in here tonight, and you're like, okay, I'm fine going and sleeping with Joe Namath in the other room. That was quite funny, actually.
that's my job here, is to bring the comments to the show.
Well, and go ahead.
And as I mentioned before, earlier in the show, Dan, I'd like to wish you a happy Armed Forces Day. We appreciate your service to our country in the Navy. I'd like to start off by asking you, give us some background on how you became interested in Ohio State football.
Well, growing up as a kid in Canton, Ohio, of course, you have very few choices in life, according to your father. And, Canton is extremely close to Pittsburgh, so I'll give a little bit of a leeway on the Pittsburgh fans that reside in Ohio, because I mean, then again, it's so close, and a lot of families, I have a lot of family in Apollo, PA, Pittsburgh, PA, so there was this gigantic overlap, and it was interesting. You talk about these wars among families, and inside my family there was the Pittsburgh side, and then there was the Cleveland side, and then thank God we didn't have any family up in Michigan, or I would have never been probably Ohio State Buckeye fan. But in Ohio, where I grew up, being a Buckeye fan was kind of ingrained really early. My my start with Ohio State Buckeyes stuff didn't really start until I was well into the Navy. You know, as Joe, you know, admit, when you're playing around living a life on submarines, you kind of you take on a role of I don't know, your mind really has an opportunity to work looking for things that get you anywhere but being on the submarine. You know, it's X number of feet long, X number of feet wide, and only so tall. There's no women there. There's no distractions. Now there are women, actually. But, you know, back in the day, so, you know, you could fantasize about, you know, your college, your pro ball, stuff would come across on the ticker tape. And, you know,
I try not to say the word fantasize when I'm talking about my sub days, by the way, Dan.
Yeah, well, you know, but
kicking back and the bunk and the birthing, fantasizing, football cards. Right?
Yeah,
I mean,
exactly. But you know, you kind of wanted to, you look for that escape, and through the sports ticker. I mean, back in the day, I mean, I joined in 1986, and we didn't have the technology they have today. So,
yep.
Radio room. I made friends quickly with the radio guys, and I would be able to go in and get the scores coming off. And it came across an old school typewriter, a teletype type of process, and you would read the score and very few details about a game, and you had to use your imagination to kind of understand
totally.
What happened.
I love that.
You know, when I was a young kid, I discovered a 1927 Ohio State Michigan ticket. In fact, that was, you know, I was early, I mean, close to 10 years old maybe, and I held that ticket. I kept it, and I used to take it on submarine patrols. It kind of became a good luck piece or a reminder of home.
Yeah.
And it was small enough on a submarine because those of you that have never been on a submarine, the space that you have, personal space, is extremely limited.
Were you an officer when you're on a submarine?
No,
I forget. I think you were. Okay.
No, so I'm an anomaly. I was fortunate enough. I came in the Navy as an enlisted guy in '86. Did boot camp, sub school, A school, and C school for technology. Then hit the fleet and submarines as electronics technician and enlisted guy. Ultimately, I made chief petty officer after three submarine tours and a submarine tender tour. And I had put in a officer commissioning program package for what's called limited duty officer. Limited duty officers and chief warrant officers are technical type officers. The type of technical officer I was picked up under is a electronics specific, which also embraces, of course, information system security management, all your automated data processing and all of that stuff. Ironically, I quickly went from submarines to my first surface ship as an officer. And Joe, you'll appreciate this. You know, this is before internet, so I'm on my submarine on my last patrol on USS Nevada as a chief petty officer. Going to commission in a few months, and I know I'm going to the USS Taylor. It's a frigate. I have no idea what a frigate looks like. So I'm in Jane's fighting ships, looking at different ships and I'm trying to study what USS Taylor is as a frigate, and that's how I learned about my first ship. needless to say, when I showed up that day on the pier, I was quite alarmed how small it was, but it was a fantastic thing. And so it was 1999 when I commissioned as an officer, and now I'm, like I said, I've been blessed. Now I'm a commander, so it's kind of two careers.
Somebody was asking me the other day about the room on a sub. It's like, oh, you'd be claustrophobic. And I'm like, I was on the Georgia, the USS Georgia, based out of Bangor up here.
Yeah.
I'm like, they're actually pretty roomy. They're 300 feet long.
Yep.
They're probably 100 feet wide. 60 feet.
Hey, I was on Georgia too. Were you and I bunkmates at one time? No, I'm kidding. I was on Georgia also.
and I'm like, it's actually pretty roomy. There's an old submarine here. The blue, I forget the name of it, but it's docked at it's docked here in Portland. It's an old sub, and its claim to fame is it was a sub that did the emergency blow in Hunt for Red October, and then right after that, it was decommissioned, and it sits here, and it's an old diesel sub. And people are like, oh, yeah, you know, when they think of subs, they think of that. I'm like, no, that makes me claustrophobic. And like, but yeah, our
boomers are the ballistic missile submarines. For those that don't know, those are your, you know, we have SSBNs, which are ballistic missile submarines, and then you have SSGNs like Georgia, Florida. They've been converted to Tomahawk delivery and Navy SEAL delivery. But, you know, we've got all of, with all the fast attack boats today, they're all relatively good size. You know, a lot of heroes over the years in submarine force, and I'm not taking away anything from my surface brethren because I'm also a surface guy, but, you know, you go back to the diesel days of, you know, the 1940s, we lost 52 submarines in the Second War. Yeah, three in the Atlantic and only and 49 in the Pacific. So,
wow, I didn't know that.
Anyway,
wow, I actually thought it would have been more, just with prolific. You know, anyways, wow, that's incredible. Well, it is, you know, the eve of Memorial Day and Armed Forces Day. So I love the little tangents like that. I'm not sure if anybody knew. I mean, I was in the Navy. You know, I was a machinist mate. Damn it. You know, I think we both went to Nuke Power School, same spot in Orlando.
You're a nuke guy, so no wonder why you keep such great notes, because you're a nuke and I'm a coner, so I'm one of the forward ET guys. That's how you guys are able to keep all your collections so perfectly square.
So
a nuclear power guy versus a coner, which is a forward person, that's almost as bad as the war between Ohio State and Michigan. Or Cleveland and Pittsburgh.
I got along with everybody. We're all on the same team. I got along with everybody, if you can imagine that. I have a hard time talking about Ohio State stuff here, Dano, because Ohio State threw up Oregon, you know, University of Oregon, you know, in the Rose Bowl a couple years ago. So I'm still struggling to recover from that. Kind of like I still don't like the Pittsburgh Steelers because they beat the Seahawks in the 2005 Super Bowl with a little bit of help from the referees. But I digress.
Well, does it help that because the Browns just, unfortunately my other team just stinks so badly that makes up for it a little bit maybe? I don't know.
No, not at all. Not whatsoever.
No, not at all. Damn it.
But thanks for offering that up. Yeah. So I collect football programs too. Mine are, you know, back from the Red Grange and Jim Thorpe days. But I still have a run of, like 1976 programs and tickets I've worked on for the first year of the Seahawks. So you also collect Ohio programs and memorabilia. Tell us a little bit about that facet of your collection, sir.
Well, so, you know, my collection kind of started with, I literally wanted, it was kind of with that small theme of Ohio State versus Michigan, just tickets only. Unfortunately, that spills over very quickly into programs and things like that. And so, you know, people, I would meet somebody and I'd be like, hey, you know, I'm really interested in this ticket. And they're like, well, I have a ticket, but I have a program also. You're welcome to both of them, but not one or the other.
Interesting.
So I kind of started, you know, trying to my goal was all Ohio State versus Michigan tickets from the first win against Michigan in 1919 up to, you know, current day, and then all bowl games. Ironically, I was actually able to collect, I'm missing like one. But then the bowl games, I was actually the 19, the Rose Bowl that we played in the early 20s, that thing's eluded me. And they're just really, really hard to come by for some strange reason. So hopefully one day I'll locate one of those. But, you know, again, so the programs, and as I don't know, as you guys know, as you start collecting, you start morphing your collection toward things that you like a little bit more. So I really started focusing on the Chick Harley era of 1916 to 1919. And that really anything pre 1930, I was just absolutely fascinated with how any young team, whether it's pro or college or even high school, you know, how do they become, a dominant team, or how do they become powerhouse? There's a lot of lessons learned in that. And it was, you know, it intrigued me to see a little school, what originally was when Chick Harley landed in Columbus in 1916, it was, you know, there was no stadium. They were putting 20,000 people in a stadium if they could possibly sell all those tickets. And, you know, and the program really started from the 1916 to 1919 time frame. And so that's kind of where I started with my programs. And, you know, now I have a fair amount of the, like, I'm having a decent time finding 1916 programs, believe it or not. 1919 programs have been a little bit of a challenge. 1917 and 18 have been uniquely challenging. 18 with the war, I mean, we're talking about the first war. So, yeah. You know, I don't know if they just reduced printing things. Or people just, you know, they did a lot of recycling efforts too during the first and second wars, which people don't realize.
Yeah. And that's a big reason why, and to me, any program pre 1942 is very rare because a lot of them did go to those recycling efforts. A lot of them were just, you know, basically thrown out type of thing. They are rare as far as
I read it. Read an article from from the World War II once, and it talks about the voracious vacuum of paper recycling, and that little adjective reminded me, you know, just reminds me of just what you said, just how much stuff just, you know, went to being recycled. I mean, and the tickets and programs, probably wasn't very nostalgic back then. So I agree with you.
Well, I mean, you know, you got to think, you know, with the war bonds movements and it was just patriotic. I mean, people, you know. The bigger bag you showed up with for recycling, the more patriotic you were, you know, and so everybody was doing it. And so it's just something to consider when we're looking at these things. And oftentimes it's not mentioned.
Yeah, totally.
What kind of Chick Harley items did you have there? I'm curious.
Well, I one thing that has eluded me, and Truth in Advertising, is one of his autographs. I've been chasing one. And then I was lucky enough to locate. So I've stored. I have. it's kind of funny that the things you admit openly in the industry, and then things you still chase. So I have, but I'm still chasing Harley autographs. Ironically, I mean, the guy lived a relatively long life, but, you know, he spent 50-some years in a VA hospital in Illinois. It's hard to believe that he didn't sign anything in any of those years.
Right.
And yet, his stuff is just not out there. So either somebody's sitting on 100 autographs somewhere or, you know, it's just not really out there and available. About 3 months ago, I was able to, I bought from an estate of a fellow high school football mate of Chick's a 1913 team photo of East High in Columbus, Ohio. So it's got Chick Harley and all his teammates from the 1913 East High Columbus team. I've never seen another. That's... Of all the things I have, that's, you know, my most, you know, and it's right here in front of me. I have it framed and, you know, numerous different photos that I've been able to locate over the years. Different folks, wrists. I've got some stuff through RMY. In fact, I bought a 1916 Ohio State versus Northwestern panoramic. It's... A lot of people that don't know, you know, Ohio State or Chick Harley don't know about. There's a thing called the perfect play. It was it's kind of been it was thrown around in the teens and in the 20s. Basically, this particular play was because Northwestern was so stacked at the time, you know, that they titled it the perfect play. And basically, Chick he ran a 63-yard touchdown against the very very heavy team of Northwestern. It's in a panoramic that I also have here, and you know,
that's a beautiful piece.
Even
that's
his photos,
you've shown
even
pictures
his photos
of that before. That's a beautiful piece.
Oh, thanks. I really appreciate it. And you know, what's the sense in collecting things if you don't have a connection to it? And that's kind of, back to the military thing, guys, I've moved 36 times in my life as an adult.
Wow.
Okay. Wow. That's literally packing all my stuff and moving to a different house. So in 30 mm-hmm. years plus 30, almost 31 years in the military, I've moved 36 times. So that keeps, that helps keep your collection kind of streamlined, and it helps you, I'm serious. I remember moves. I literally went and donated, 100,000, 200,000 baseball cards that were, 1990 stuff, late 80s. Unfortunately, one ended up being 500 Sammy Sosa rookies, and then he went on a tear, and, but the Harley stuff, I have some really, really good solid photos. I've started, focusing on the 1916 season, particularly because that was his first one, tickets. I have, 4 of the tickets from the 1916 season, which are, wow. As you guys already mentioned, they're uniquely hard to locate. And one of the,
any of them are,
well,
yeah.
Well, we played Oberlin one 1916, scored 128-0. That particular ticket I have that ticket, and then it was signed on the reverse by Lynn St. John, who was the coach, which is pretty neat. And then the Illinois game from 1916, which was a huge game.
Oh, yeah.
That was the field was super muddy. It was a low scoring game. It was something like, I think it was 7-6 was the final, and the Ohio State scored late in the game, and the field was so muddy that apparently Chick Harley requested a new shoe, a replacement shoe. So he called over. The kid just calmly walks over, puts this new shoe on, goes out in the middle of the field, kicks a damn extra point, and wins the game. And it was, it's kind of one of those. You have people in the heat of fire. I've been shot at.
Yeah.
You have some people that just bring their game, and then everybody else is panicking, And that's kind of why I associate with this little 5'7" guy, because I'm gigantic, tall guy at 5'6", and a guy like Chick Harley, you kind of look at what he did and what. And so I just kind of connected to him.
That quiet leadership is incredible. I like it.
Well, it's just
reminded me of the captain. Yeah, it's just fascinating. So, well, you mentioned you moved quite a bit, Dan. So you whittled your collection down. We always like to ask people what the top 5 items in their collection are. I think we've heard about a couple of them, but what do you consider to be the top 5 items?
Still have the 1927 ticket that I've been carting around all these years that has been on every deployment, every patrol. So that's literally right here at my desk.
That's very cool.
One of the things that is a 1916, so it's Ohio State versus Wisconsin ticket and program. A lot of people, they kind of call that Harley's, that was the game where he had his breakout game, where he kind of could grab the national attention even at a young age. This kid was coveted by Michigan, Notre Dame, other major universities wanted him, and he went to this small school, Ohio State, for some reason. And, so that's one major thing. And I already mentioned the Ohio State, the Oberlin college ticket with Lynn St. John on the back. Also, I have an Illinois ticket from 1916 season as well. And then, I already mentioned the 1913, the East High photo from his junior year. And, the thing is, too, is I haven't been insanely stupid either about the things I collect, because I have storage units in the States still loaded with baseball and football cards, I must admit.
Hmm. Oh, very cool. Wow.
So I have, I have safe deposit boxes, of course, things like that. Because when I was a little kid, maybe that's why I connect with Harley. When I was a little kid and growing up in this, I was born in '67. So, growing up in the 70s and 80s, I didn't identify with anybody in that era. I would go to baseball card shows, and I'm walking around buying 1950s Brooklyn Dodger cards for no reason. You know, you mentioned finding football was really hard, but baseball was abundant. And I kind of became a fair-weather fan through baseball cards of baseball and, of course, Cleveland Indians. And I started collecting, you know, I fell in love with the idea of the Brooklyn Dodgers, the New York Giants, the New York Yankees,
yes.
the Cleveland Indians, just these teams
yes.
from the 50s that I never saw play, but there were all these stories. Do you guys remember card shows in the 70s, the guys that were sitting at the tables, they're talking about these stuff, you know, they're like, remember Mickey Mantle and, you know, Roger Maris in 1961 and they hit the, you know, and I felt as a child of two divorced parents, a connection through these collectors. And I just fell in love with the idea or the romance of 1950s baseball and football. You know, I'm like 13 years old walking around buying up Jimmy Brown rookie cards. So I recently took delivery of one storage unit and some of my stuff was in there. And I discovered that I had 255 Bowman sets, 254 Bowman sets, a 48 Bowman set. I found some Chickles from 35.
You're collecting those
way back.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
Wow.
So I had a connection with that stuff and some of the first baseball cards I bought were T206, 1952 Bowman.
Great set.
Found them in a flea market that my grandparents, we went to, and I still have those things. They're still in the same plastic bag that they were in when I bought them. It was funny, you were talking about the 1965 set that you still know the original ones, and you still know the 15 that you bought afterward.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I still have the 54 Bowman and Tops that I bought from my neighbor, his dad and mom, they didn't want them. And he traded me an old bike that I had, for some 54 Bowman and Tops. He was happy and I was happy.
You know, it's
that's
those
very cool.
early memories buying that kind of stuff. And you just remember where you were. And you remember what took place. You remember the transaction. You remember it was a show or whatever it was, or you traded the bicycle with the neighbor, so on and so forth. You know, those are all things really, really stick in your mind. And, you know, I'm going to be 59 this year. I still remember stuff when I was 7 years old like it was yesterday with a lot of these
cards.
But,
see, that's why we collect, though, I think, you know, because it – you know, all of us, you know, all of us can go back and we can reflect on life and say, geez, I've had some really hard times. But then you look at a baseball card or a football card, or there's something about your collection that it takes you to a time when you remember when things were much more simple.
Right.
You know, I shared the story about I was in Sicily and came across an antique market, and there was like 1,000 1958 and 59 Topps baseball cards there, all in fantastic condition. And next to a World War II stretcher of all things, you know, an Italian World War II stretcher. And I'm sitting there, and my wife's looking at me like, what the hell are you doing? You're shelling out this money for, what are you buying these things for? And I was like, you have no idea. And it just,
I've collected just basic stuff up until, you know, but I can remember, 78, 79 football, 80. And at some point, you know, some kid on my school bus had a O.J. Simpson. And I remember I had to trade probably like 30 cards, but I wanted that O.J. card. He was still playing at the time. Yeah, and it's interesting. I can remember being on that lunch or on that bus, kept all of my cards, you know, rubber banded together in my lunch pail. You know, you're right. It is a simpler time.
That's probably the problem with
any...
the majority of the stuff I have in storage is because it's all in probably rubber bands, and I mean it's been there for. I haven't seen some of the stuff in 20 plus years, guys.
Wow. Do you have
any
memorable collecting experiences you want to share with our listeners? You discussed several already, but I don't know if there's one that really sticks out over the years.
I got to be honest. I mean, honestly, collecting, we all have great stories. But I can, this story is probably, collecting actually, you know, when you look at your credit score and you look at, you're like, how did I survive those lean years? I know some folks have had to sell, some things over the years and they look back and regret. You know, I had a period of time, my starter wife, the mother of my two girls, she ran us into a bunch of debt. She took off. She wasn't even home. I was on submarine deployment. I had no idea none of this was going on. I came home as a young E5 petty officer, second class, looking at about 10 grand in debt. Both car payments were behind. The house payment was 3 months behind. No bills have been paid. And I literally grabbed some binders and went to a local car dealer in Charleston, South Carolina. The guy was extremely fair with me, gave me a decent price on my cards. And quite honestly,
wow.
You know, I don't look back on with any kind of regret. It was actually, this is how collecting is kind of, I use it as a philosophy of, it's also an investment.
Yeah.
And in this case, you know, this particular situation, you know, it saved my skin. Had I had cash or liquid cash or liquid anything. And so I know it's not quite the same as what you guys normally get as far as, like, you know, people find these gigantic finds and things like that. I kind of wanted to point out the fact that besides the great people that are in the collecting, I know some, there's a lot of skepticism about, greeting and companies and things like, and I don't get into any of that stuff. I try and, you find great friends in collecting, great friends through the networks, discard those that you know are not good, and stick with the tried and true. And it's been I've been doing this for, I'll be 49 or I'll be 50 this August. And, I've been collecting 40 years, and I've had,
wow,
I'd say 98% of the time has been great experiences so far. And
wow,
meeting folks like,
wow,
you guys. And I'm my first national. I've never been to a national. I'm excited to come. I'm flying all the way from here, really to come see you, knucklehead. So I'm excited. and, you know, just spill some beers and
cool,
talk about cards and,
the national, for those who've never come, it's an amazing experience. That's all I got to say, and it's even a greater experience when you meet people who you've talked either, you know, on the phone or online for years, and you meet them in person,
mm-hmm,
for the first time. It's an amazing experience, and I can guarantee you, Dan, you won't regret coming out to Rosemont
this year's
national. That's gonna be, you'll have a phenomenal time. I'm sure you will. I'm sure you will. Even
people have
Joe,
been so
have
amazing. Oh, so Joe's going to be there? You sure?
I'm working on it. I'm working on it. My wife's mom is having some health issues that we're trying to work through.
I told Joe he has to show up at least one day there. I don't care if he gets off the airplane and then picks up a red eye that night. He's got to come. Well, we're almost out of time.
I have one more quick question. I'm sorry, Bob. Chick Harley was. I had to Google this, but a couple days ago before you came on. But Chick Harley, I noted, and you touched on it too, was put in a VA hospital where he spent most of his life. And I know he was diagnosed with a schizophrenia or something like that.
Schizophrenia.
Yeah.
Yeah. Honestly, guys, I think he showed every symptom of what we now call CTI. If you go back and look at his timeline of how this absolute rock star in high school, normal kid in college, you look at his face and pictures. It's almost like, if you look at him from 1916 to 1919, and then he played, he went to the Bears, ironically, in 21. He mm-hmm, was there briefly. He was a part owner in the Bears, him and his brother. And he was already showing major signs of dementia. And his face was like a roadmap of, I think, honestly, playing in leather helmets, taking, you know, major hits to the head. Also sure. In 18, he was in an aircraft incident as a pilot training for World War One. And, you know, it's just hard to say.
So he spent, you know, from like age 24 to age 74 when he passed away. He spent 50 years in a VA hospital.
Yeah,
wow.
54
incredible.
Years. And
just incredible.
He escaped one or two times out of Danville. He would, like, ditch the place and then show up somewhere, and then they'd return him. So that happened a couple times. But other than that, he was inside the hospital the whole time.
Wow. Wow, that's hard.
What a sad story. Well, Dan, I thank you so much for being on the show today. I appreciate it, and we will break bread when we see you in Chicago. I look forward
Dan,
to meeting
you're awesome.
You in person.
Thank you.
Yep. And we'll be talking
I appreciate it, guys.
Yeah, thank you, and I owe you an email back about your Brown inquiry that you sent me an email to. Sorry about that. I'm a little distracted lately.
No worries, guys. I it's an honor, and back to you and what you guys do for the community, Gridiron Greats. You know, it's hard for actually magazines and articles are hard for me to get because it's hit or miss whether they come or not. So, guys, folks are sending them to me, so I get them always and read them avidly. But what you guys do back for the community and then and the community at large has been fantastic and very supportive of each other. I mean, I see on the different forums that are out there, and it's just unbelievable how the community comes together. So I look forward to meeting you guys.
Okay. Thank you, Dan.
Very well said, Dan. Thank you. And have a good night. I know it's I had to look it up again, but I know it's 6 o'clock. They're almost 7 o'clock, so we'll grab some dinner.
Thanks. Sure. You guys have a good one.
See you, buddy. Thanks.
Take care.
Joe?
Bye.
We're
yes,
running
sir.
Out of time here. Let's go right into our goal line stance. Pick up on tonight's show.
It gave me goosebumps. I've known Dan a long time and never spoken to him because of the time difference. But that was great to hear him and talk to him. I mean, we're kind of a kindred there. I mean, both being ex-Navy, well, he's currently Navy, just both, you know, the Navy and then obviously a passion for collecting. Just he mentioned it, you know, a couple times there, just you know, the passion for the hobby and how you pick up good friends. I mean, through this hobby, and I would put him in that present company. Just a great show. You know, tip of the hat to you, sir, for getting him on. You know, that was pretty cool.
And I want to add to what he said that 90% of his experiences have been positive, and he even took a bad experience and made it a positive with the issues when he had to sell his collection to pay the bills. And, you know, as much as I've become somewhat of an old grouch in the hobby, I still look at the positive of the people that I've made friends with. And a lot of people who, you know, believe it or not, I've traded cards with for 30, 35 years now. And it's a nice hobby, and if we can just maintain the positive aspects of the hobby and not the people trying to steal from one another in the hobby, I think it's a much better hobby in the long run. And I appreciate what Dan said. And you know what he said. And, you know, you and I, you know, we're on the same wavelength as far as helping other collectors and trying to promote the hobby and doing that.
Well, all right. Well, I've had my bad experiences with wax packs and cellos. I moved on. Even the 48 Leafs, you know, being trimmed, you move on and you become an advocate to help educate other collectors. So.
Well, yeah, there's so much other stuff, and that's a big reason why I'm turning back to publications again. And you know, I just love reading about the game. I love the magazine. I love the media guide. I love the program. I love the older books, and, you know, to me, that suffices me. I have no problem picking up, you know, programs from the 70s, from crying out loud, and rereading them again, and just following them. All right, we're almost out of time. I get real quick again. We're sponsored by MSB Sports Cards. Check out their website, msbsportscards.com, and BSC Auctions. Check out their website, bscauctions.com. We'll be back in June for two shows. I'm taking a necessary break over the next few weeks, and we'll be back in June with a couple new shows and a couple new guests. Joe, I look forward to hopefully seeing you this summer at the National. And,
indeed, yes, sir.
Thanks for being on today. All right.
Happy anniversary to you and Brenda, by the way, Bob.
All right. Thank you very much. I appreciate it.